Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here in sunny Virginia. I appreciate the welcoming weather. It's a great pleasure to be at Virginia Commonwealth once again. I've been here before, in fact, several times. It's always a pleasure to see Howard Rosati again, an old friend and someone whose work I very much admire. I want to thank Adam Welch for the particular invitation and the Graduate Student Association as well. Now, let me say what I'm doing here. Obviously, the title, and you see this from the poster as well, is a reference to Kandinsky's very famous and influential essay in German, Über das Geistige Kunst. I use the German word deliberately because the word Geist in German has a whole different resonance and history than the word spiritual in English. Spiritual sounds a little sappy in English. When we say somebody is spiritual, we're not certain if we're giving them a compliment or being ironical in English. But in German, if you say somebody is a geistiger Mensch, that's a true compliment, somebody deep, reflective, and serious. Now, this paper is coming from a number of different points of view or trying to address a number of different issues. First, I think it's high time to reevaluate 20th century art in a serious way. It's been scholarly done to death, so to say. Everything's been analyzed. There are lots of books on Kandinsky and people associated with him. His influence has been widely acknowledged. He's a truly famous major figure. In my humble opinion, ultimately more of a revolutionary than Picasso. André Breton, who is not known for kindness, praised Kandinsky, I'm quoting Breton, as one of the most exceptional, greatest revolutionaries of vision, which I think is quite extraordinary statement. I'm not sure that people have fully gotten a hold of why he's so exceptional. Now, one of the things that I think is going on in Kandinsky's art and in on the spiritual art is an effort to deal with an issue that was raised in Hegel's Phenomenology of Mind, which was published just about a century earlier, Phenomenologie des Geistes, sometimes called Phenomenology of Mind, sometimes Spirit. There are various translations in English, Phenomenology of Consciousness. And Hegel, if you read it very carefully, reaches a curious point. He goes from sense experience, okay, very particular sense experience, to pure ideational spiritual experience, and he argues that the climax of spiritual activity, let's use that word, is the spirit knowing itself and coming to itself. And then suddenly, having said that, he flips right back into sense experience, and he says the spirit knows itself most through sense experience. So we have the idea of spiritualized sensing, so to say, implicit in Hegel. And the whole thing starts over again. And I think Kandinsky is trying to address that moment, okay? Now, I think there's something else that's very important that's going on today. I'm very interested in maintaining what I call the spiritual impulse in art, and I frankly think it's disappearing. For me, the debate in art is symbolized by the difference between Gerhard Richter and Anselm Kiefer. I found it a wonderful relief to see Kiefer's recent show at Gagosian Chelsea. I found it a wonderful antidote and relief from the show by Richter at the Museum of Modern Art, which is now in San Francisco. You can buy a book for $125. It has an aluminum sleeve on it. It's the ultimate hype, okay, of an artist. There are 8 reproductions in it, 2 texts by prominent artists. It's a very slick production. I've written about both of these people. For me, Richter is the ultimate in the spiritless, cynical artist. I have a piece at artnet.com where I wrote a lot, which called Gerhard Richter DOA. Didn't make me many friends, but I'm getting too old to worry about that. And then I have another piece on artnet.com called The Spirit of Grey, which is about Richter. The subtitle of the Richter piece, which is on Kiefer, not Richter. The subtext was the last ripple of the German wave, the Deutsche Welle, as it was called when it happened. But anyway, Richter is spiritless, Kiefer is spiritual, and one of the last holds out. The last show was dealing with the Kabbalah, with an interesting text on it by Harold Bloom. It was sensational, well-received. You may be aware, if you're not, I'll make you aware, that Richter has sharply attacked Kiefer as too pretentious, too much into the sublime, etc., among other things, okay? I think that's a mistake. So that's one thing I want to address. The other thing I think that's happening, and that Kandinsky stands right in the middle of, is that we're at a moment of paradigm change, as it's called. It's been going on for a while in the history of art. I believe that the idea of fine art is dead or dying. The idea of fine art, which emerged in the 18th century, symbolized by Kant's aesthetics, and there was no concept of aesthetics in traditional philosophy, and then by the discourses by Reynolds, that's on the way out, it's going. I think art is becoming very ideological, and it's less interested in mediating this special experience called the aesthetic, which you can get outside of art, but which is intensified and more concentrated within the, so to say, closed circle of discourse, which is art. So I think Kandinsky is bringing together the spiritual idea of art with the aesthetic idea of art, or let's say the spiritual impulse, and trying to unite them, okay? So this is some of the things I'm going to do. Now I'm going to show works which you're probably familiar with, and I will talk a little bit about them and say things I'm sure you're familiar with from Kandinsky. But then what I want to do is to shift it a bit, perhaps in terms that may be a little too general, but it's hard not to be general in the context of such a talk, shift it a bit and try to talk about just exactly what is meant by the spiritual impulse, keeping the spiritual alive. I also have to say that there's a subjective motivation behind this talk. As one gets older, one becomes aware of sickness and death. One becomes aware of what Buddha was aware of when he left the closed garden of his pleasures and went out in the world and saw a sick person, a dead body. He couldn't believe these things existed. That began his spiritual pursuit of enlightenment. And you might say the sub-question, as it were, of this talk is, can art still offer spiritual enlightenment as Kandinsky thought it once did or was capable of doing? You may disagree with that. You may not do it. I remind you that Kandinsky, along with Malevich and Mondrian, were all spiritual artists by their own testimony. This has been forgotten. Nobody takes their writing seriously. A while back, Hilton Kramer said, oh, it's all just about formal innovation and impulse and spontaneity, but it's more complicated. The issue is whether it is still possible to represent spiritual impulse without the traditional iconography. That's what they were trying to address. So without further ado, I'll begin. It is almost a century since Vasily Kandinsky wrote on the spiritual and art. Why reconsider it now? It was written, published 1912 by Pieper Verlag, and there are a number of essays related to it done in 1910, 1911. Not simply because of historical reasons, not simply because it is time to take a fresh look at a text that had profound influence on 20th century art, and some people regard it as the climax of symbolist thinking in art, but because art faces the same problem now, at least in my opinion, that it did then. Namely, how to generate and articulate what Kandinsky called, I quote, the all-important spark of inner life, or as he also called it, of inner necessity. As he said, it is the core of spiritual experience, quote. The problem is even greater today, in my opinion, than it was in Kandinsky's day. What he meant by the spiritual was self-evident to his audience. Today it is not so self-evident. For Kandinsky's audience, and for Kandinsky, its meaning was anchored in religious tradition. Today, there is no religious tradition to sustain it. Thus, when Kandinsky described how he came to the idea of spiritual and art, when he said, quote, he realized that the sensations of colors on the palette, this is direct quote, could be spiritual experiences, and that's right out of Hegel, as Kandinsky said, he described how he felt as though he was, I'm quoting again, taking a stroll within a picture, that he was surrounded on all sides by painting whenever he entered a church. He was a very smart man, very, very introspective and knowledgeable about himself. And he said how he wanted to recapitulate, in part, the experience of walking through a Russian Orthodox church, which is full of pastel colors. And anybody who's been in Russia has gone to some of these churches. There's a wonderful group of them outside, right outside of Moscow, will know what he was talking about. It didn't matter whether it was a Russian Orthodox church or a Catholic church, as he said. The experience was the same, whether it was the Moscow churches or the Bavarian and Tyrolean chapels. It was an artistic experience of religion and a religious experience of art, a sense of the easy and seamless merger of religious and artistic experience, their inevitable reciprocity. The interiors of the churches and chapels that Kandinsky visited are brightly and intricately colored, as he was quick to appreciate, so that the excitement of color and of inner life converged. Color and feeling were inextricable. Sense experience was spiritual experience, and spiritual experience took sensuous form. That is, the external, visible phenomenon of color seemed to be a spontaneous manifestation of the internal, invisible phenomenon of feeling. Feeling needed color to become consummate, and you can think of Matisse's remarks in his 1908 essay, same kind of thing. He talks about fascination with color, the instant effect of it. Feeling needed color to become consummate, and color needed feeling to have inner meaning, to be more than a chemical matter of fact. Kandinsky insisted, as we know, that certain colors and certain emotions necessarily went together. They were not simply arbitrarily or culturally associated, but essentially connected, as he argued in the chapter, I'm quoting, "The Psychological Working or Emotional Effects of Color on the Spiritual in Art." Now, the public who read On the Spiritual in Art when it first appeared, and also the Blauer Reiter, the Almanac, the Blue Reiter Almanac, when it appeared a year later, the second edition appeared in 1914, and that was the last edition, in which he and Franz Marc, who's a close friend, edited together, thus understood what Kandinsky meant when he declared that, quote, "Their principal aim was to awaken the capacity for experiencing the spiritual in material and in abstract phenomena," close quote. It was, to repeat, a religious experience, an experience of inner life. Church going induced it. That is, it forced one back on one's inner life in forgetfulness of the outer world, the world outside the sacred space of the church. And the picture is a kind of sacred space for Kandinsky. And Kandinsky thought that abstract painting induced it as well, if only because in entering an abstract painting, one turned away from, again quoting, "the external aspect of phenomena," as he said, toward what he called feelings of a finer nature. And he makes quite clear, he's not speaking about ordinary feelings, for example, the kind of feelings that Munch talked about, anger, anxiety, and so forth. He's talking of a different kind of feeling altogether that he did not associate with what you might call natural existence. What mattered for Kandinsky was what he called the mood, Stimmung, or spiritual atmosphere, his terms of the work. And he has a very interesting footnote deploring the fact that the word mood or Stimmung has become so banal and conventionalized. And not its material or outward aspect. The work had to be seen with what he called spiritual eyes, eyes that could intuit inner necessity, not eyes that could see only physical, material, or outer necessity. When Kandinsky spoke of my tendency, I'm quoting him now, "my tendency toward the hidden, the concealed," he was talking about his ability to see the spiritual concealed in the material, the unfamiliar emotional reality behind familiar material appearances. As he famously wrote in a letter to Will Grohmann, great German scholar, in 1925, quote, "I want people to see finally what lies behind," that's Kandinsky's emphasis, "my painting." On the Spiritual in Art begins with a long diatribe against what I called, I'm quoting, "the long reign of materialism, the whole nightmare of the materialistic attitude, which has turned the life of the universe into an evil, purposeless game," close quote. Another reason for reconsidering, and as I hope to show, the necessity of reaffirming the spiritual in art, or the spiritual possibilities of art, if you want to put it more modestly, is that we have not only not awakened from the nightmare of the materialistic attitude in art, as well as society, but materialism has become a plague, indeed the reigning ideology in both. Kandinsky thought that Impressionism was materialism's climactic statement in art, but then he never saw pop art, which began the ascendancy, not to say dominance, of media-derived art, which is the situation we're in today. The attitude of pop art is so materialistic, however ironical its materialism is supposed to be, and I have my doubts about that, that it is virtually impossible to find any spark of inner life in it. One can make the same criticism of Warhol's Marilyn Monroe, and maybe the reality of Marilyn Monroe as well, who Billy Wilder said he was not sure if she was a human being or a synthetic creation, synthetic plastic, he said, as Redon made of Manet. Redon, who wrote some rather brilliant criticism, said Manet's figures lack, quote, soul. Inner life is what he meant. There is certainly none in Andy Warhol's media mannequins, which is what he paints and what our celebrity society is saturated in. One of the reasons that Kandinsky was concerned with inner life is that it registers the pernicious emotional effects of outer materialistic life, affording a kind of critical perspective on materialism that becomes the springboard for emotional transcendence of it. The inability of pop art to convey inner life, which is a consequence of its materialistic disbelief in interiority, and especially spirituality, which is the deepest interiority, indicates that pop art's irony is at best nominally critical. Irony, in fact, mocks belief, even as it spices up materialism, making it seem less banal, that is, populist, thus giving pop art the look of deviance characteristic of avant-garde art. I dwell on irony because it is opposed to spirituality, not to say incommensurate with it, and also its supposedly more knowing alternative, spiritual, people supposedly naive, and because irony has become the ruling desideratum of contemporary art. If you're not ironical, you're not in. Apparently redeeming its materialism. This itself is ironical, for contemporary materialistic society and its media have discovered the advantage of being ironical about themselves. Namely, it spares them the serious trouble of having to change. This suggests that irony has become a form of frivolity. It is no longer the revolutionary debunking understanding it once claimed to be, for example, in Jasper John's American flag paintings, but an expression of frustration, of stalemate, I would say. Now, for Kandinsky, modern materialism was evident in, quote, the turbulent flood of technological inventions that has poured forth, as he noted in Wither the New Art, which was published the same year as On the Spiritual and Art, and also the obsession with the accumulation of material blessings. We live in America and know what that's all about. But he never experienced, Kandinsky never experienced the blind faith in technology as the solution to all human problems, nor the wealth, however unequally distributed, of our business society, which, as we clearly have realized from the recent corporate events, is a swindle. It is possible to argue that in art, which is what we are concerned with, materialism has completely swept the field. People think of art in completely materialistic terms. What does it cost? What is it going to bring on the market? And the joke is that the real galleries are the auction houses. So that searching for the inner life of a work of art or expecting any art to have spiritual significance is like searching for the proverbial rare needle in a haystack. There is usually no concealed, to think of Kandinsky's idea, spiritual point in most contemporary art. Nothing unexpected that would sting the spectator's spirit into self-awareness. To put this another way, there is little that is sublime, which is an idea that Kandinsky also used, about contemporary materialistic art, that is little that would awaken the capacity for experiencing the spiritual. Materialism has increased exponentially in art and society since Kandinsky's day, as the business ideology of today makes clear. I think Warhol's idea that business art was the most important art and making money was business puts it on the line quite explicitly. As he said, he passed through this thing called art, okay, whatever that was. Business materialism is evident in the eagerness for corporate sponsorship of art. One may say corporate legitimation of art's significance. Without a corporate sponsor, without commercial value, no historical and cultural value. Business materialism is also evident in the implicit belief that the work of art is a commodity before it is anything else, part of the consumer society, normal enough. That is, its commodity identity is its primary identity, or to put this another way, its marketplace value is its primary value. It seems more and more foolish and farcical to speak of a work of art's internal necessity when it seems designed to cater to, even ingratiate itself with, external necessity. It is harder and harder to know what one is talking about when one does so. It is harder and harder to claim that a work of art can be a spiritual experience. However much such artists as Mark Rothko and Barnett Newman, I'm sure you know the difference here, insisted that one was missing the point of their abstract art if one viewed it materially. They were not mere technicians of color, to use a term that has been applied to Rothko, but spiritual provocateurs. Ironically, marketing materialism has given art more visibility and prestige than it had when it served religion and the aristocracy. It is a two-way street. Business's enthusiastic endorsement of avant-garde art's professed autonomy is business's covert way of asserting its own autonomy. That is, its belief that, like art, it is answerable and responsible only to itself. By supporting art, business appropriates art's supposedly intrinsic value and claims to advance consciousness. Ours is a business culture, not a religious culture, and it is impossible to find spiritual significance in what Warhol called business art. I submit to you that Warhol's art is a celebration of business, which is in part why it sells. It is certainly a long way from the color mysticism of the interiors of the churches that Kandinsky visited and that his early abstract works struggled to emulate. Corporate headquarters are not churches, even though their decoration with works of art are attempts to give them spiritual significance. Warhol's gold Marilyn Monroe, which I showed you before, 1962, is also irreconcilable with Kazimir Malevich's abstract icons, which he compared to spiritual experiences in a desert, the proverbial place to have them. In contrast, Warhol's work epitomizes the business materialism of the crowd. It's what I call crowd art. Ironically, Warhol's cynical attempt to turn the dead actress into a sacred presence, and she was very good business, like Elvis, reinforces her profaneness and spiritual insignificance. Gold is either filthy lucre or, alchemically speaking, ultima materia, that is the ultimate sacred substance, and Warhol's perverse fusion, and perversion is another major strategy in art, and irony is part of it in contemporary art, the perverse fusion of its opposed meanings in the socio-cosmetic construction of Marilyn Monroe is the ultimate materialistic nihilism. It is the exemplary case of the confusion of values that occurs in a business society and that Kandinsky fought against. What I am arguing is that the spiritual crisis of the contemporary artist is greater than Kandinsky's. Kandinsky knew art was in spiritual crisis, whereas today's materialistic artist doesn't see any spiritual crisis. All that matters is materialistic success. I want to just call attention to something, interrupt myself. Earlier this week, I received an announcement of new books from Prestel Verlag, which is a German firm located in Munich with offices also in New York. And one of the books is called The Eclipse of Art, Tackling the Crisis in Art Today. It's written by Julian Spalding, who is the former director of the Glasgow Museum and also the man who founded the Ruskin Gallery, the St. Mungo Museum of Religious Art, Religious Life and Art, and the Glasgow Gallery of Modern Art. I have to say this struck a resonance with me because my next book, which will be out at Cambridge University Press early next year, is called The End of Art. And I'm taking this in a different way than he is. I'm arguing that we now are in a situation of post-art, as I call it. That's a term that Alan Kaprow introduced earlier on, and I sort of run with it and do a variety of other things. So there are a number of people, Spalding is one, I'm another, and there are other people I can mention, who feel that something is, quote, wrong in the state of art today, as there was in Denmark way back when. The spiritual crisis in art today is more comprehensive than it was in Kandinsky's time, all the more so because what Jacques Barzon called the modern religion of art in his Crest lectures many years ago, it's an absolutely brilliant book on art, written in the 70s, as I say, his lectures that he gave in Washington. However a private religion it was, and thus more of a cult, is defunct today, however much its vestige lives on in the pseudo-sacred space of the museum, of the modern museum. I was recently reading about the New Dallas Museum, and apparently you have huge walls with a single work on it, like a sacred experience, okay? I hope it works. Kandinsky could fall back on the religion of art and contributed to its growth, but today it seems quaint and simplistic, which is why many contemporary scholars and interpreters ignore the spiritual writings, as I said, of Kandinsky, Malevich, and Mondrian, regarding them as so much claptrap beside the point of the actual works they produce. The last religious works of art, the so-called purist works, and this is my interpretation of them, one possible interpretation that Clement Greenberg advocated and analyzed, have become history, marketplace as well as art history. Even more crucially, Kandinsky's assumption that color, these are his terms, transmitted and translated emotion, that inner life had a necessary material medium, universally accessible and instantly expressive, has fallen by the wayside. The relentless materialization and mediaification, if I can invent a word, of art, which are accessories to its commodification, has stripped it of the sense of subjective presence so basic to Kandinsky's belief in spiritual experience, leaving us with what, from Kandinsky's point of view, is the shell of art rather than its spiritual significance. The point I'm trying to make is that there is no longer anything hidden or concealed or behind art as Kandinsky expected it to be. It's all up front. What you see is what you get, as has been famously said by Frank Stella as well as Andy Warhol. Stella, I think, strips, along with Ellsworth Kelly, strips abstraction of its spiritual import, reduces it to what I call empirical abstraction. Spectrum, or think of the spectrum works of Kelly, for example. If what you see is what you get, then art has lost its internal necessity, that is, its subjective reason for being, and become completely objective or external. One no longer experiences it, but theorizes about its material structure and social meaning. And think how much theory props up art today. I am in complete agreement with the famous art historian and museum director, Friedlander, who said that when theory rises up, creativity is on the way down, at least for the artist, if not for the theorist. In other words, belief in the spiritual has been completely uprooted and destroyed in most contemporary art. The idea of the spiritual as such has become meaningless in the art world, thus completing the process of the despiritualization or demystification of art that began with Cubism and climaxed in post-painterly abstraction, as Greenberg thinks. In a sense, and I'm going to contradict myself what I said before about Greenberg, Greenberg's theory of modernist painting is in fact the final intellectual stage of the modern process of despiritualizing art, which in the last analysis is reduced entirely to the terms of its material medium. Such materialistic reductionism involving the complete objectification of art, it is a case of what Whitehead called misplaced concreteness, is evident in Greenberg's assertion, I quote, that the great masters of the past achieve their art by virtue of combinations of pigment whose real effectiveness was abstract, and he puts that in quotes, and their greatness is not owed to the spirituality with which they conceive the things they illustrated so much as it is to the success with which they ennobled raw matter to the point where it could function as art, close quote. Greenberg, Stella, and Warhol have more in common than one might imagine. They're all radical materialists. For them, the spiritual effect of art, the sense of spiritual intimacy, and I emphasize that word intimacy, it can achieve, is a case of misplaced materialism, that is, a naive misreading of art's physicality. For them, the spiritual is an epiphenomenon of art's manipulation of matter and as such a misapprehension of art. They ultimately want to eliminate the idea that there's something spiritual about art as dishonesty. Honest art involves the attempt to master matter, including, for many artists, social matter. At best, to say that an art is spiritual is simply a way of saying that its mastery of matter is successful, or at least convincing to the viewer. This makes the artist a kind of chef who knows how to cook the material medium so that it's tasty and looks appealing, which gives it all the presence it will ever have and need to be credible, simply as art. The idea that the artist might invest his or her subjectivity in the material medium, which is what brings it alive. Indeed, the idea that the artist might have a profound subjectivity, and that to be an artist, you have to be a certain kind of person, that is, experience the inner necessity of spiritual aspiration, and that the only person who can legitimately call himself or herself an artist is the person who experiences art as part of a personal spiritual process, this idea is discarded as absurd and beside the artistic point. Thus, the apparently revolutionary materialistic conception of art is emotionally reactionary. There is another factor that makes art's situation today more difficult and desperate than it was in Kandinsky's day. The avant-garde has been conventionalized, not to say banalized. This is more than a matter of institutionalization. It is a matter of its bankruptcy. It has run out of creative steam. The age of artistic revolution and innovation is over and become redundant, feeding on itself, and not always to refine its principles and methods. A good part of what motivated Kandinsky was defiance of convention, as is evident in his pursuit of what he called unrestrained freedom. He spoke of this in an essay on the question of form, which appeared in the Blue Rider Almanac. This begins, as he wrote, I quote Kandinsky, in the effort toward liberation from forms that have already reached their fulfillment, that is, liberation from old forms in the effort to create new and infinitely varied forms. Close quote. It climaxes in a sense of what he called unbridled freedom fraught with active spirit, that is, feeling. Quote, again, the feeling that speaks aloud will sooner or later correctly guide the artist as well as the viewer. I read that again. The feeling, in quotes, that speaks aloud will sooner or later correctly guide the artist as well as the viewer. But what do you do if there's no feeling there? The problem is that what was once unripe new form has become overripe old form and no longer seems so infinitely varied, and what once seemed like emotional liberation, fresh and unique and revolutionary feeling, has now become stale and pro forma. The avant-garde has reached its fulfillment, to use Kandinsky's language, and become decadent. And I think we are in a time of decadence in art. The moment of unpredictability and improvisation that was so important to Kandinsky, and that he struggles to achieve in the abstract works produced under the auspices of On the Spiritual Art, and I want to point out that his scholar Richard Stratton has noted that this has a unique place, this essay, in the history of avant-garde thinking, for Kandinsky's ideas were developed before the art that exemplifies them was made. That is, On the Spiritual Art is prospective and prophetic rather than retrospective and rationalizing, as many artist statements are. That this moment of unpredictable improvisation has passed and vanished, never to return. It is incidentally worth noting that the root word of improvisation is not to foresee, which is not the same as accidental or spontaneous, which is the way Kandinsky's work is usually understood, by chance or by impulse, and why improvisation is more enlivening than either. And Kandinsky's whole point is that art has to be inwardly alive or it is not worth the creative trouble, since the results of chance and impulse can be foreseen, however not precisely predicted. As Franz Marc, Kandinsky's close friend and colleague, wrote in the preface to the second edition of the Blauer Reiter Almanac, as he wrote, I'm quoting Marc, with the divining rod, we search through the art of the past and the present. We showed only what was alive and what was not touched by the tone of convention. The problem of feeling alive in a society you feel is inwardly dead is crucial for modern existence. We gave our ardent devotion to everything in art that was born out of itself, lived in itself, did not walk on crutches of habit. We pointed to each crack in the crust of convention. It's marvelous and sort of inspiring words. Only because we hope to find there an underlying force that would one day come to light. It has always been the great consolation of history that nature continuously thrusts up new forces through outlived rubbish, close quote. Well, nature itself seems like outlived rubbish in modernity, and especially postmodernity. We are in a nature holocaust, as it's been called, environmental holocaust. in the midst of it, and no new spiritual forces have come to light in art. Avant-garde art has become habitual, a dead letter with little spiritual consequence, however materially refined.